meat in front of him, losing his appetite the moment Yuka arrived at his table. Already he had received word from Zakan in Zandalar that the assassins who had come after Queen Talanji at the council feast had struck again. They were organized enough to have taken a name, the Widow's Bite, and they had managed to wound several guards at the palace before kidnapping two civilians. The message from Zakan lay curled next to his untouched plate of food. He had taken a small residence in the Valley of Spirits, little more than a lodge to keep his belongings and a bed. The other council members had agreed to more luxurious accommodations, but Thrall preferred the modest house. A larger home would simply amplify the emptiness, the absence of his wife, Agra, and his children, Durak and little Reezy. No, a simple hut would do until his family could join him, or the Horde no longer needed him.
"Not going to eat that."
Yuka leaned against his carved shaman's staff, twirling his grey beard thoughtfully.
"You have come to steal my supper or do your job, Yuka."
The shaman smiled, but it didn't reach the wrinkles at his eyes.
"Old friend, your missive reached Nordrazil and I carry with me the reply. The Night Warrior bids you come on one condition."
Thrall shifted, even less hungry than before.
"And? Spit it out."
"She says you must bring what is owed."
Frowning, Thrall scratched his chin.
"What else did she say?"
"Nothing."
Yuka shrugged and reached for the haunch of boar growing cold on the table, tearing off a piece of charred skin and eating it.
"She claimed you would know what that meant."
"I see. And how does she seem?"
Emboldened by Thrall's disinterest, Yuka tore off a larger piece of boar meat.
"Her rage has not lessened, if that is what you mean."
"Of course not. Were it me, my rage would simmer for 1,000 years. "Very well. I can linger here no longer, waiting for messengers and quelling council squabbles," he sighed. "And this will only cause another one."
Thrall pushed himself up from the table, lumbering over to the door.
"Boy,"
he called. The head of a skinny orc page appeared, shoving aside the leather curtain protecting the doorway.
"Run to the hold, quick as you can. Summon Kalia Menethil and Bane Bloodhoof. We depart for Nordrazil before sundown."
"Right away!"
The boy vanished, and Thrall crossed to the large, ancient chest of his belongings next to his spare bed. He fished out a clean leather harness and a woven red cloak, one Agra had made while teaching their children to weave. A subtle design of yellow and darker crimson ran along the border, and Thrall traced it with his fingers.
"Home."
He shrugged on the harness and draped the cloak around his shoulders while Yuka rubbed his chin.
"The undead woman and the High Chieftain. Are you certain that's wise? Will they not both remind her of the Banshee Queen in their own ways?"
"Bane despises Sylvanas, and the feeling is mutual,"
Thrall replied, leaving the hut with the shaman trailing close behind. It was well known that Sylvanas Windrunner considered Bane a soft-hearted liability, even before he sought to overthrow her. Her hatred of the Tauren struck Thrall as a ringing endorsement, and now that he had come to know Bane better and witness his devotion to the Earth Mother and to the spirits, his respect for the chieftain only grew. Sunlight dampened by a haze of dust roasted the city, and Thrall found himself longing for the cool, shaded pools dotting the land on his farm in Nagrand. He could almost hear the laughter of his children splashing in the water.
"And the woman?"
Yuka asked.
Carlia Menethil wishes to bridge the divide between the Forsaken and the Kaldori that have recently found themselves raised into undeath. I see no harm in it.
They stood side by side, the old shaman leaning heavily on his staff, while Thrall surveyed the warren of streets under the shaman's quarters, packed with shops and forges, anvils ringing day and night as blacksmiths tried to replenish the deficit left by the blood war. Yuka cringed at his words.
You disagree?
Thrall's eyes followed the page, Gunk, as he wound his way through the mundane chaos of the commerce below.
It would be better if you came alone.
Half the council is already convinced that I will be ambushed in Nordrazil. Some small concessions must be made,
Thrall said. At last, Gunk vanished, bare little feet flying out of sight and well on his way to the Valley of Strength.
Go back inside and finish the rest of my supper, if it bothers you so.
At that, Yuka barked with mirth.
Ha! Earthbinder, to go without me would indeed be your downfall.
I have negotiated safe passage with the druids protecting the World Tree. I am to escort you and your chosen companions.
Thrall flinched at the old title. It did not fit him anymore.
Well, I feel safer already.
Yuka ignored the jab.
Tiala assured me that passage to the World Tree would remain safely open for us. I am to guide you there and then to Taranda's location. After that, you're on your own. You must bring what is owed.
Thrall was no fool. Surely Taranda Whisperwind and Malfurion Stormrage desired some gesture, some remuneration for the war crimes visited upon Teldrassil. Even in Naggrand, even cut off from his connection to the powers of a shaman, he had felt the moment the world shifted, and the wrath of Sylvanas Windrunner set the Kaldori capital ablaze. It was quiet, it was distant, but he heard a collective cry, and for a brief, terrifying moment, he tasted smoke on the air where none had been before. What did he owe? How did he answer that? He had not been part of the Horde War that led to the atrocity, and that, perhaps, was why Taranda and Malfurion were willing to meet with him at all. Innocence in one specific crime felt like a weak shield, but perhaps he had more. He gazed over the raised plateaus and flying banners of Orgrimmar and imagined it aflame, imagined the city that had been the source of so much life and joy and war and pain reduced to smouldering rubble. What would he want if such a thing were to happen? What would he need? What possible balm could soothe a wound so impossibly deep? They exchanged mounts at Valormok, leaving behind their long-maned wind riders for four saddled and restless hippogriffs, their feathers a brilliant rainbow of blue, purple, and green. Fortunately, the largest of the beasts was able to accommodate Bane's considerable heft. Thrall spent the exhausting ride in subdued contemplation, hardly noticing the open scar of the strip mines outside Orgrimmar, and then the far more placid view of the South Fury River. The burnished trees of Azshara diminished into just a smear of blood across the land as their hippogriffs lifted them higher, higher, following the path of a churning waterfall until at last Mount Hyjal sketched itself in behind the evening mist. The skies darkened to a striking imperial amethyst, and the first glimpse of the World Tree came, roots gripping the mountainside like gnarled hands.
Oh,
he heard Carlia Menethil say softly to his right.
Oh, but it is beautiful.
Nordrazil,
Bane Bloodhoof added, echoing her delight.
The crown of the heavens. What a gift
to walk in the shade of the world tree. Look!
Kalia pointed to a pair of playful fairy dragons chasing each other across the surface of the lake below Nordrazil. They flew in a spiral, then dashed back toward the hills and the clearing where Thrall, Kalia, Bane and Yuka made their descent. The dragons passed within inches of Kalia, their purple and pink wings ruffling her hair. They dismounted, safe as Yuka had promised. The hippogriffs were wrangled and taken away while they waited in the almost oppressive calm.
The light here is so different, the way it strikes the leaves,
Kalia murmured, gazing up at the world tree, its top unseeable in the clouds by even the keenest eyes.
And the flowers, have you ever seen blossoms of truer blue?
By my father's spirit, it is truly a blessing from the Earth Mother.
Bane knelt, the beads adorning his horns and armor twinkling as he admired one of the flowers, inhaling its fragrance. Thrall watched the gloom of night crawl toward them, encroaching on the clearing, stone pillars topped with bright azure flames, the only wards against the darkness. For all the fresh air and pretty flowers, Thrall couldn't allow himself to be at ease.
There is a pall over this place,
he said softly. Under the eaves of the inn nestled against the roots of the tree, a Hyjal warden, cloaked in the brown and green sigil of Nordrazil, kept vigil. Only Yuka heard him.
We should move quickly. Come.
The shaman led them, skirting the grey-timbered inn and taking them down a shallow slope to the banks of the crystal-clear lake. With a tap of his staff against the damp earth, the water ahead of them turned sturdy enough to hold them all. Yuka pressed on as swiftly as aged legs would carry him.
Take care with your words,
Thrall warned Bane and Kalia.
Perhaps it is better now to listen,
Bane replied with a solemn nod.
Chatter will not help heal old wounds. Yes, you sense the darkness that hangs over this place.
Morning,
Kalia spoke gently, her footfalls as delicate as raindrops on the watery path. I did not at first realize the beauty of the world tree is overwhelming. But Thrall is right. This is a place in mourning, and we are trespassing on their grief. Thrall nodded, heartened that they both understood the gravity of the situation. He had chosen his companions wisely.
I would not have come at all, but the spirit realm is fractured, and our shaman cannot find a cause. That is too dire to ignore,
Thrall said, reiterating an argument he had made before the council when justifying this very journey to Nordrazil. On the other side of the lake, another hill rose, this one crowned with three silver tents, the poles intricately carved with leaves and painted moons. Thick blankets and furs were spread before the tents, along with a low cushioned bench, the arms carved into owls. Seated beneath the bench, a night elf girl plucked dolefully at a lute. Thrall hardly noticed the somber music, gripped instead by the two regal figures seated on the owl bench. As they neared, one of the figures stood, observing them, but refusing to bow or give any respectful sign of recognition. Arch-druid Malfurion Stormrage made an imposing impression. Tall and strong as time-worn timbers, the antlers of a stag growing from his head, feathers sprouting from his arms, and an emerald beard longer and finer than Yuka's hanging from his chin. And where Malfurion embodied the forest and its creatures, his wife, Tyrande Whisperwind, was a sublime manifestation of Ilune, the goddess of the moon. Her white enameled armor, chased with silver, might have been woven from starlight itself. Two even turquoise braids framed her face, the clean loveliness of her garb and hair making the blackened pits of her eyes all the more unsettling. Malfurion and Tyrande were not alone, and Thrall was surprised to find both Maiev Shadowsong and Chandris Feathermoon joined them. The two night elves had been in whispered conversation behind the bower, but grew silent at the horde's approach. Maiev's cold steel helmet, winged and sharp, stood in unsettling contrast to the harmonious natural beauty all around them. Only her emerald green cloak, trimmed in cloud-soft fur, blended into their serene surroundings. Chandris Feathermoon had come as armed and armoured as her companions, a fall of dark blue hair spilling from the top of her leather helmet, her eyes hidden, though he hardly needed to see them to know they were unfriendly. Yuka stopped them several feet from the edge of the carpets, and Thrall stood shoulder to shoulder with him. Nearly two heads shorter than Thrall, Kalia waited beside the orc, Bane to her left. Expecting a chilly reception, Thrall bowed deeply, relieved to find that his council counterparts did the same.
As promised.
Yuka also demonstrated his respect for the Kaldori leadership.
Thrall, son of Durotan, High Chieftain of the Tauren, Bane Bloodhoof, and Kalia Menethil, Princess of Lordaeron, and Counselor of the Horde Forsaken. They have come to discuss the disturbances noted by the Shaman of the Earthen Ring and the Moonglade Druids.
Tyrande merely tapped the musician on the shoulder. The girl strummed one last time and then grew still. The insect night song of the glade began, though it did little to assuage the awkward silence. Thrall kept his attention on Tyrande, as she had locked her eyes on him and did not look away.
Thank you for agreeing to this meeting,
Thrall began, his voice unexpectedly ragged. He cleared his throat and pressed on.
Yuka and others feel a sinister interference in the spirit realm. Our dead are not passing on as they should, and they are heedless of the shaman attempting to guide them.
Nothing. None of them so much as blinked, though it was hard to say, with Maiev and Chandris wearing their helmets. He decided it was a safe bet.
Yuka tells me your priestesses have made similar discoveries,
Thrall continued, growing a little angry. His cheeks burned with the indignity of their reception. In different days, younger days, he would not have abided the insult.
We have come seeking answers. Will you speak with us?
Nothing. Frosty, rigid silence. At his side, Kalia shifted nervously. Thrall collected himself before saying something rash. He looked into Tyrande's eyes once more, into the hypnotizing aura of darkness, in the never-cool embers of her eyes. That moment in Nagrand returned to him when he tasted smoke and sensed a far-off pain. That pain was not so far off for her. It was constant and as potent as the day Teldrassil burned. They had once stood together, he, Tyrande, and Malfurion, all three of them defending Nordrassil. That tree they had managed to save, but now the crime of its sister burning must be answered. They had even witnessed his marriage to his wife, Agra, there in the shade of Nordrassil's venerable branches, though that seemed many lifetimes ago now. Perhaps Tyrande's rage had obliterated those memories altogether.
I brought you what you wanted, what is owed,
Thrall said, and at last he saw a spark of life in her eyes.
I bring you the sincere apology of the Horde. We are not a single voice, now spoken through the mouth of a war chief, but a whole host of voices. We have formed a council so that never again will one take power and abuse it as Sylvanas did. As as Sylvanas used that power to slaughter your people.
He could swear the moon above glowed brighter, as if the mere mention of the Banshee Queen's name had ignited its anger.
Kalia Menethil has come. She stands as an example of how we hope to change.
Thrall soldiered on. Kalia nodded, but mercifully kept silent.
Lillian Voss now speaks for the Forsaken. Both women seek to reforge themselves anew, free of Sylvanas, free of her poisonous influence. Those who are sympathetic to the traitor have been exiled, her loyalists torn out by the roots. Bane Bloodhoof even sought to overthrow Sylvanas and remove her as warchief. It is only a shame that he did not do so sooner, and that Mor did not listen.
Was he speaking to a wall? Would nothing move Tyrande? Even Malfurion gave him the smallest nod of understanding, perhaps only indicating that he was listening. To his surprise, Chandra's Feathermoon removed her helmet, revealing the red tattoos and startling white eyes beneath.
You will understand our hesitation, Thrall. Even promises made by our own allies have been broken. I would hear more of what you have come to say, but only because I crave justice as dearly as I crave healing for our people.
Maiev scoffed.
Have a care, Chandra's. Listen to his honeyed words at your peril. Believe him at your peril. Join the Horde to hunt Sylvanas at your peril. For once the deed is done, you will again find their daggers at your back.
At that, Tyrande almost smiled. Chandra's wispy brows met in frustration.
I believe justice is action, Maiev. I have told you as much before.
Whose action? Maiev demanded, her sharp voice shattering the peace of the glade. The Horde's? Whose action? What justice? For I will not be content with only Sylvanas Windrunner receiving her due. She was not alone when Teldrassil burned.
Bane was imprisoned for opposing Sylvanas,
Thrall reminded them.
Not all of the Horde stood with her that day.
And yet she spoke for your side, acted for your side, Maiev shot back. The War Chief is the voice of the Horde, the hand of the Horde, but now you have scattered yourselves to a council, dispersing the blame, hiding behind cowardly revisions of a history that will not be forgotten.
She punctuated her anger with a step toward him. Carefully, Chandra's drew her back. I doubt you would like to be held accountable for every mistake and crime committed by the Alliance, Chandra said in a soothing tone.
Aye,
Bane spoke up.
What is justice to you now? Must Thunderbluff burn? Must Orgrimmar? Will the deaths of our innocents appease you? Do you think pain does not simply bring more pain?
High Overlord Sarfang engineered the siege with Sylvanas, though he had no intention of destroying the World Tree,
Thrall added.
His part cannot be forgotten, but he is now in the grave, put there by his own warchief.
Kalia Menethil glanced between the far taller, larger Bane and Thrall, then softly joined her voice to theirs, quietly, but no less firm and sure. These disagreements are a distraction. Our divided sides only keep us from apprehending the one who gave the order. Maiev swiveled, watching for Tyrande and Malfurion's reaction, but neither of them replied. In the lingering silence, Chandra's ventured her opinion once more.
If we agree to a temporary understanding, she said, obviously picking her words with care. Then we do so, not to exonerate the Horde entirely. It is but the strategy of a moment. I see no reason why this cannot be.
I see many reasons,
Maiev muttered. Taranda, it seemed, still did not care to speak. The elf began plucking her lute again, but Taranda slammed her hand down on the owl-shaped arm of the bench, demanding a return to silence. Had the moon grown bigger in the sky? Was it somehow closer? Threatening?
It was not yet time.
Malfurion's grave baritone filled the clearing. He leaned down toward his wife, placing a furred, clawed hand on her shoulder.
This was folly. Let them go.
Taranda uncrossed her legs and sat back on the bench, shaking off her husband's hand with a tight grimace. And then, all at once, she cared very much to speak.
When you have washed the bodies of 1,000 Kaldori burned and broken, when you have fallen to your knees and kissed the feet of 1,000 mourning souls, when you have looked into their eyes and tell them our horde has changed and they believe you, only then will I accept your apology and treat you as my equal.
Taranda's voice, edged as steel, pulled the air out of the clearing.
My brethren here may be willing to entertain your empty pledges of justice and aid, but I know better. I have learned better.
Then she stood, and Thrall worried that the moon might truly fall from the heavens and crush them at Taranda's command. Her eyes, though black, somehow glowed, Ilune's fury blazing colder and brighter along her skin with each word. The glade itself grew grey and almost dead, as if by her will she had sapped the life out of everything around them, withering the trees and obliterating the flowers and grass to dust.
How many orphans did your horde create that day?
Taranda sliced the flat of her hand diagonally across her body.
Those children will grow. They will wake each morning tasting ash, and one day they will come for you. Oh, they will come for you. And they will make you taste that same ash, and then you will know their justice.
She sat down again, as if winded. Light returned to the clearing. The plants around them were green and vibrant once more.
Quickly,
Yuka muttered, trying to gather them.
We must go. This was a mistake. I should not have brought you here.
Bane and Kallia allowed Yuka to corral them back toward the path of glittering solid water. Thrall remained, only taking slow, careful steps, never showing Taranda his back. For his trouble, Taranda directed her final words to him, and only him.
You will find that justice less sweet than the sorry excuse for punishment you faced. And when this justice comes, there will be no armistice to save you.
Thrall felt Yuka grab him by the arm and yank. But he did not agree with the shaman's assessment. It was important and right that they had come. Thrall had thought he knew what Taranda wanted, that what was owed was his remorse. But now he realized his error. He easily shook off Yuka's hand and pressed his fist to his chest to prove his sincerity.
I will bring you what is owed then. I will not bring words or promises. I will bring you the head of Sylvanas Windrunner.
The faintest trace of a smile appeared on Taranda Whisperwind's face.
Do it then, or never seek to speak with me again.
Chapter 15. Dazar'alor. The nightmares had come frequent enough that Talanji could recognize them for the falsehood they were. Recognizing them was different from escaping them. Still, as venom dripped from fangs as thick and white as river beast tusks, the first corrosive splash landed on Talanji's shoulder. She screamed, helpless to protect herself as the spider hovered over her, jaws descending, razor sharp. So close. Thrashing, kicking, twisting, nothing helped. No hope. The creature in Shadra's own image pinned Talanji to her bed, its eight legs trapping her like a living prison. Its abdomen heaved, silk threads filling the chamber, the threads that would form a deadly cocoon and Talanji's mausoleum. The giant spider opened its dripping mouth wide, and Talanji cried out once more. Inside, struggling to get out, she saw the face of Besame, the inconsolable father who had come to beg for a queen's lenience so that a young marriage might blossom. But the widow's bite had taken him from the palace during one of their raids on the city, Talanji's patrols finding Besame's corpse at the edge of Nazmir, charred almost beyond recognition. The troll clawed at the spider's insides, desperate to get out.
Help me! My queen! My queen, help me!
I cannot!
Talanji thrashed harder. If this was the end, if she was to be visited by all her failures, then she would not simply lie still and die without a fight. One name might save her. One cry for aid might actually banish the nightmare. Tears streamed down Besame's frantic face, and then his skin began to blister and burn, his pleas buried in the spider's thorax as the beast clamped its jaws shut and lunged for Talanji.
Buansamdi!
The image of Shadra stilled, then broke apart, fragmenting into puffs of blue smoke that gradually faded, rising to the ceiling like candle smoke. Just another dream. Another nightmare. It didn't matter. Talanji gasped for breath, leaping out of bed and grabbing up the blanket, wrapping it around herself while she wiped at the very real sweat on her brow. As she pulled her hand away from her forehead, she saw deep lines carved into it, wrinkles that had not been there the day before. How could that be? Was ruling leeching the life out of her so quickly?
Yakald?
She excelled and sat back down on the edge of her bed, knowing Buansamdi waited just on the other side of the immense golden platform. A merciful breeze, humid yet cool, blew in from the open balcony window. Talanji turned her face toward it, greedy for the relief it brought.
It was only a nightmare, she said. Shadra wanted me dead, and the poor fada they stole from the palace was inside her. It felt so real.
Because your guilt is real.
Buansamdi appeared before her, the azure fire eyes behind his mask glowing dimly.
Take a look outside, my queen. Your nightmare is not over. Something must be done, and soon.
Talanji hissed, clutching the blanket to her chest and padding on bare feet to the balcony's edge. She tried not to look at her visibly withered hands. The lower of graves spoke true. Fires burned bright in the jungles below, eight pinpoints of light in the darkness. Either she was still emerging from sleep, or Buansamdi appeared shaky, translucent, as if he were only half present.
How is it possible?
Talanji bit down hard on her lip, a rage building inside that would soon spill out or consume her.
My soldiers patrolled the jungle tirelessly, yet somehow they slip by. They raid my city, attack my palace, attack me. How did they grow so strong so quickly?
Buansamdi floated beside her, surveying the work of the widow's bite. Talanji had not been idle. meeting with her council each day to discuss new approaches, new tactics. They had the superior force and superior resources, but their own land worked against them. The Widow's Bight could use the jungle to stay hidden, their scattered numbers an advantage against an army spread thin by the size of Zuldazar. And many, even in the city, she knew, remained suspicious of her rule. Those sympathetic ears might become sympathetic mouths, spreading the lies and terror of the group, eating away at the stability of Talanji's rule.
"What do we do?" Talanji murmured. "How do I stop what I cannot see? They have no fortress, not even camps. By the time my guards find them, they are already gone. We are chasing vapor, fighting fires that are already smoldering coals."
"They attack you because of the pact your father made," Bwamsamdi told her, waving his hand toward the chaos below.
"They think I control ya. And they fear what my queen, a queen of death, might become."
Talanji glared.
"I am not your queen." "Tell them that." He gave a dark laugh. "They be burning my shrines, breaking the magic that protects them, killing my priests where they stand. If they burn many more, I won't be much help to ya. Aloha is nothing without believers and prayers."
"It's harming you," Talanji gasped. "You're growing weaker."
The Loa nodded gravely.
"And you?"
"Me?"
She collapsed back against the balcony wall, hopelessly frustrated. Holding up her hands to the light of the braziers, she forced herself to look at them.
My hands. What is happening to me, Bwamsamdi?"
"We share a bond, little queen," he sighed. "We share a fate. If I have no followers, if there is no tribute, no faith, then I will be all but gone. My strength weakens, and tethered together, yours weakens with it."
Talanji swore, stuffing her hands under the blanket to hide them.
"Then these shivers, this pain in my chest."
"It will get worse, Talanji, unless you protect me. You must protect me."
She heard the true fear in his voice and wondered how she was to stand tall and courageous when even a god was afraid.
I cannot accept this."
"Accept it or not,"
Bwamsamdi bowed his head, the flames in his eyes even dimmer.
"It is the truth."
Talanji inhaled shakily.
"If true, if then how do I fight these rebels? Can you not help me?"
The Loa chuckled, but it was utterly mirthless.
"You have soldiers, Talanji, and you could have many, many more. I think you already know how to fight the rebels."
"The Horde. Of course." The Ambassador Zakan wouldn't stop pressing her to return to Orgrimmar and accept a place on the new Horde Council. A position that would give her what, exactly? She needed troops and ships, not empty promises. But her stubbornness wouldn't put out fires, and the Zantruli Council had offered no solutions, just repeated concerns. It was up to her. It was always up to her. And now her life was on the line.
"I will never accept peace with the Alliance," she said, stony. "But I will ask for the Horde's help. This is growing beyond us."
"Good, good."
Bwamsamdi grinned at last.
"An attack against me is an attack against you. If they destroy us both, who will protect Zandala?"
Talanji narrowed her eyes, suspicious of that grin.
This is no small thing you want from me. The Horde is working with the witch that killed my father. The Horde is content to ignore the crimes of Jaina Proudmoore, but I never will be. So if you want to get what you want, Loa, I will not go empty-handed.
Empty-handed?
Bomsamdi cackled at her, an unkind sneer twisting in his mouth.
You get a kingdom and your life. I'd say that's more than fair.
And I am rid of this bond between us, Bomsamdi. Rastakhan's deal. I want it no longer. And if I am to abandon my pride to the Horde, then you will abandon this pact. My life is my own, tied to no others.
Talanji felt her breath catch in her throat. It wasn't often she gave an ultimatum to a lower. And from the grimace on Bonsamdi's face, he clearly disapproved. But she did not back down from the lower of death. If he needed her so badly, then he could compromise. It was only fair. It was time, at last, for her to be making the deals.
I don't think so, little queen.
Why? Can it not be undone? Our pact, she asked. Will it kill me to break it?
No, Talanji. But you would regret it.
You have the Loa of Graves on your side, the loyalty of a god. Did you really think there would be no drawbacks?
The breeze whistled between them. Then a crackle, as the flames spreading through the jungle claimed a stand of trees and sent them toppling over. Screams punctuated the night. The room behind her grew frosty and fogged, a blast of energy sending her toppling against the bed as Bomsamdi mustered what little strength he had, thundering,
"Foolish girl! Nothing to say?"
Talanji whirled to face him. She did not cower. She did not speak. Let him throw his tantrum. The high ground was hers to keep.
"Reckless child of a reckless king! Consider yourself lucky you be working with me and not another Loa,"
Bomsamdi spat. In his rage, he expanded to fill the room, his hair brushing the ceiling. Then he diminished, his eyes once again dimmer and less blue.
"Yuzala would eat ya alive."
Even the mention of the other Loa's name made Bonsamdi's image waver and blur.
"I would tell him the same thing,"
Talanji stated, defiant. She might have only been a young troll in a bedsheet without crown, without jewels, without a weapon, but she was still the queen.
"Ya will regret this,"
Bonsamdi assured her, shrinking further.
"Consider the deal struck, girl. Protect my shrines. Keep us safe. And when I am strong again, our pact will be no more. You will have your life back, all your own. But you may not like what it means to be all alone."
Chapter 16. Dazar'alor. Zakan hopped lightly from foot to foot, waiting for his moment to speak. The Zanchuli Council had put him down on their schedule, an emergency meeting called at dawn to address the growing threat of the Widow's Bite. He had never before presented officially in front of a crowd of important strangers, and the pressure squeezed him from every direction. The answer, he felt, was plain. Talanji needed help from the Horde. The Horde wanted to give it, and she simply had to be convinced that her personal vendettas mattered less than the safety and security of Zandalar. However, the likelihood of swaying her to his point of view seemed less and less as she paced before the council in their lofty golden chairs, her voice clear and decisive, the council nodding in agreement with nearly every word.
The widow's bite would have us believe that they are everywhere and nowhere,
Talandi was saying.
But this is not true. They have made a mistake. Now we know what they want. They want to weaken Bonsamdi because they believe it will weaken me.
Servants in glittering headdresses and feathered skirts took vigorous notes behind the council members, scribbling frantically on tablets while Talandi continued her speech to the silent, enthralled audience.
They will continue to target places of Bonsamdi's power. His shrines, of course. And more importantly, the necropolis. It must not fall. But knowing where the rebels will strike means we can put a stop to this now.
She stilled, facing her council with her head held high.
We protect the shrines. We protect the necropolis. And the widow's bite will be forced into open conflict.
Zakhan began to applaud, moved, but realized he was alone in doing so. Not only that, he was not there to support her plan, not really. He needed her to ally with the Horde. That was the primary reason Thrall had sent Zakhan in the first place. He cleared his throat and slipped further into the shadows behind the pillars of the Great Council Chamber. The chieftain of the Darkspear tribe had arrived just hours before dawn, alarmed by what he had read in Zakhan's messages. A brutal storm had begun to rage off the coast. The way unpassable by sea, air the only available route. Even that was dangerous. One of Gazlo's flying machines had been able to safely drop him off in the harbour, but only just, damaged by the electricity brewing in the clouds, crashing offshore the moment Rakan set foot on dry land. Zakhan had greeted his arrival with relief, thrilled to have support from not only a member of the Horde Council itself, but a close friend of the Queen's. Chieftain Rakan stood, blood-red tabard and leather armour a stark contrast to the blue and purple and gold-clad council members.
I agree with your assessment, Queen Talanji,
he said.
But we best send those patrols now. Sentiment in the city is not good, Your Majesty. These attacks make you look incompetent and weak.
To her credit, Talanji did not flinch. War Druid Loti, enameled armour blazing under the brazier hanging above the council, stood and grunted her agreement.
The rebel threat ends today. Then let a force be assembled.
Natal Hakata, blue-haired and golden-tusked, roared.
The necropolis is vast, with many tunnels where little spiders might hide. It will take a great deal of resources to secure it.
It was time to step in. Zakhan wasn't on the schedule until after Zulani was slated to speak. But he knew this was his one opportunity to intervene before their enthusiasm and certainty grew too powerful to overcome. He not only had a duty to the Horde to represent their interests, but the Lower of Graves himself had bid him change Talanji's mind.
No pressure whatsoever now. Ancestors, protect me.
If I may...
Zakhan swore he heard a parrot flap its wings 6 miles away in the abrupt, chilling silence. He tiptoed around the pillar concealing him and stood in Talanji's shadow, her arms crossed expectantly.
Ah, Zakhan, come forward, boy. What do you have to say?
Rakan gestured him forward.
Let us hear from our Horde ambassador. Do we really have time for this?
Natal Hakata muttered.
I can be brief.
Zakhan hurried to the centre of the great chamber. It reminded him of the grandeur of Gromash Hold. How many great decisions had been made there? How many executions decided? How many wars declared? Just a jungle boy from the shores of the Echo Isles. Varric Sarfang had taught him to see war differently, to see it as the preventable horror it truly was. Zakan made a fist, holding that thought in his hand like a talisman. What he said next might save the lives of many Zandalari warriors, and further on down, it might save lives in the Horde if Talanji were to join her strength to theirs.
Speak, boy!
Natal Hakata demanded, impatient.
Don't send your soldiers to the necropolis!
Zakan blurted. Bad start. He winced and tried again, this time slower.
The queen is right. Wamsamdi must be protected, and all the people of Zandalar too. But you can't do it alone. This is a Zandalari problem.
Talanji stalked up to him, nearly butting against his tusks.
I am not unreasonable. I can bend. The Horde may send their troops, if and when they agree to lend me the same troops against the Proudmoors. No, no, no. They will never agree to that.
Zakan countered.
And what then? Your people think you're weak now. What will they think when you can't protect your own shrines and temples from a band of rebels?
Rumbling from the council. Interest from the council. Zakan pushed on, sensing his moment.
You will get one chance to write the ending of this story. So far, your people have only witnessed defeat. Can you stand to show them one more? Why take that chance? The Horde is willing to stand with you. With their help, with their strength, we can write that ending, a victorious ending. Right now.
Talanji looked ready to throttle him, but she kept her temper, her chest rising and falling faster and faster.
This is propaganda. The boy has a point.
Rokan stroked his chin thoughtfully.
The only propaganda I be seeing is what the widow's bite spreads against us, my queen. That tide is turning, and without a decisive victory, the rebels could raise the whole city against you. If the queen's rule is truly threatened,
the Tortolan Lashk spoke up, head craning farther out of his shell.
Then inviting the Horde's forces back here could be a mistake. I mean no insult to you, Rokan, but what if your generals see an opportunity to invade?
Lashk speaks wisdom.
Talanji nodded, reiterating.
There are already rumors of such in the city. If the Horde is to come, then we must have certain promises in return. Justice for our city. Revenge for the Alliance siege. These rumors.
Standing, the chieftain Rokan stepped down from the raised platform where the council members sat. He regarded first Talanji, then Zakan, his voice low with weariness.
I have my doubts about these rebels. They be too fast, too smart. Maybe Aloa be helping them, or maybe something else.
Zakan blinked.
Like what? I don't know yet, boy, but I intend to find out.
Rokan pushed by them both, separating them, leaving the council chambers with slow, deliberate steps. On his belt, his red dagger flashed with cunning magic.
You won't have my support either way until we know more, Queen Talanji. The ambassador here be right. We only get one chance.
Talanji went after him, and then the others. Arguments erupting between the council as they adjourned without any official call to do so. Everyone and everything was in an uproar. Zakan stared, speechless, buffeted this way and that by the leaving council, trying to drop a word in on conversations he was not welcome to join. Before he could think of something that might keep them all there, the chamber was empty, even the note-taking pages fleeing. Scratching his head, Zakan tried to piece together what had just happened. He'd persuaded some of the members, at least a little, but Talanji remained impossible to reach. And here he thought she was growing more sympathetic to the Horde. What would it take? What would make her see that she need not stand alone?
Thanks for listening,
Zakan called after the long-gone council.
I think. Oh, they heard ya, boy. They heard ya. And ya did well.
The voice wrapped around him like a vice, wringing all the joy and lightness out of his body before he could breathe again. Wam Samdi. The Loa had come to visit, his unsettling, masked presence somehow weaker, as if he was stretched thin, a well running dry.
I didn't do well.
Zakan slumped his way to the platform, sitting on the edge of it, just below where the council chairs gleamed with hammered gold and jewels.
Talanji won't trust me. She won't trust the Horde, and we're running out of time.
Wam Samdi floated down to meet him, sitting to his right, his bones in armor rattling as he descended. His presence cast a shadow over everything. Even the sun outside lost some of its heat and shine. Still, his image was thin, worryingly so, like linen breeches almost worn through.
You're new at this. Don't be so hard on yourself, boy. Some of the council will be listening to you, and that's no small feat. They see something powerful in you. They see what I see.
At that, Zakan straightened. A Loa, a god, thought he was doing a good job, that he was powerful. It didn't seem real. But no, he had heard the words, and he felt them lift his sinking spirits. What had he done to find his way into the presence of so many influential beings? Maybe Wam Samdi was right. Maybe he truly was powerful.
Ancestors, you never let me down. And what do they see?
Zakan chuckled.
Besides a failure. Someone they want on their side.
Zakan jumped up and straightened the Horde colours draped over his shoulder.
You're right. The council did listen. And if they can listen to me, then so can the Queen. I can't give up.
He felt the Loa walk in stride with him toward the wide open archway that showed the carpet of green jungle blanketing Zandalar. The fires had gone out, but the smoke still rose in pillars of dire warning. The Loa walked in step with him. Zakan closed his hand into a fist again, holding on to that moment. Holding on to the faith and trust of a god.
Don't give up, boy.
Wansamdi's amused chuckle filled the chamber, but there was a note of sadness to it. That only strengthened Zakan's resolve. The Loa needed protecting, and Zakan would see it done.
Don't give up.
The Loa's words drifted down to him as Wam Samdi gradually disappeared, nothing but his blue flame eyes remaining in the blinding light of dawn.
That's the spirit.
Chapter 17. Nazmir. The sound of a flute infiltrated the captain's quarters, made thin and muted by the layers of timber separating Matthias Shaw from the crew below deck. Across him, down the considerable length of a well-used and lacquered table, Flynn Fairwind tapped his foot to the music boot bouncing as he sang along under his breath.
You can go join them, you know,
Matthias pointed out, studying him over the edge of his book. It was a history of Zandalar, old and somewhat out of date. Dry stuff. His companion, however, seemed more inclined to cozy up to his bottle. Flynn shrugged. A chandelier of lanterns rocked back and forth, sending light skittering across the table toward the pirate. Crew has less fun when captain chaperones. They need time to relax and just be themselves.
Don't you need that also?
Matthias asked, cocking a brow.
Everyone does.
Flynn nodded to the water-damaged book he held.
Except you. Don't you ever stop working?
Not really.
Flynn snorted.
See?
Fine.
Matthias closed the book and placed it on the table, then stretched his stiff arms over his head, groaning a little.
I stopped working. What now?
You're hopeless,
the pirate chuckled and rolled his eyes, but swiveled and managed to put down the bottle for a moment.
What shall we discuss?
This was your idea,
Matthias replied. Sometimes on the Baldarva, when the sailing was smooth and the work of the day done, the crew would all sit around telling tales and singing. But Matthias kept to the captain's quarters. Flynn often joined him, ever inebriated. But most nights he would just sip to keep his end of the conversation flowing. At first, the constant company annoyed Matthias. But gradually, as he was prone to do, he built a profile of the strange and fascinating Flynn Fairwind. He wondered if he would ever truly understand Fairwind. He seemed to him a man haunted, smiling and laughing to distract from something else. Maybe he didn't need to understand him, though the desire to remained constant. It was simply in Shaw's nature to try and scrape away the facade and see what lay beneath. And that skill, that obsession, made him good at his job.
My mother was a thief, you know,
Fairwind blurted out then, unprompted. The ship creaked around them, a sailor's lullaby, rocking them just like a doting mother might do. Maybe that was what made Fairwind say it.
I did not know,
Matthias responded. Sensing this was going to be a long talk, he stood and fetched himself a rare tumbler of wine from the cabinet behind him.
She was.
Fairwind sighed and shook his head, raking both his hands through his long, golden brown hair, then fussing with the ribbon, tying it back.
Always insisted she was a barmaid, but one night I hid under the bed in our cottage and waited for her. She must have thought I was out back playing, but no, I was watching.
Matthias couldn't help but lean forward a little, interested. Flynn smirked.
I could only see the hem of her skirt and her shoes, worn through to the soles of her feet. She went to a loose brick by the hearth and pried it up, then stuffed a few necklaces and brooches in there.
Did she catch you?
No, he shook his head. I waited until she went back out looking for me and popped up, crawled out of the window, and scrambled around in a bush to make it seem like I had been out there all along. For a while, I was, I don't know, angry or sad, because I wanted her to trust me. But then I realized any mother willing to do that for her son, risk her life and her liberty, must be full of love.
And bravery,
Matthias told him softly. At that, Flynn snorted, looking at him askew.
Says the man working for the crown.
You work for it now, too.
Blimey, you're right.
Flynn reached for the bottle, chugging liberally. It was Matthias's turn to smirk.
So, where is she now, your mother?
Flynn made a clicking sound with his cheek and stared at the bottle for a long moment. She's dead. Hanged for being a thief. I think that was the day I stopped being a stupid little boy. I made myself go and watch. I remember being so small I could barely see anything in the crowd. He laughed bitterly at the memory, then gazed out the curved windows that showed the darkened sea. He kicked his feet up on the table, boots scuffed and salt-stained. I remember the sound most of all. Everyone but me knew when it was coming. And then there was a breath in, everyone all together. And then he squeezed his eyes shut, and Matthias held his wine midway between mouth and table, transfixed. And then? And then a crunch, like a hammer striking wet gravel. I thought I would hear her scream or cry out for me. But no. Just the breath in and then the end. Matthias flinched and put down his wine, then turned the tumbler a few times.
No little boy should know that sound.
You've heard it before, I gather.
Yes, many times.
Does it always make you feel sick? Fairwind asked.
Always.
Matthias knew they had both killed the conversation, even if unwittingly. But he didn't want it to end.
My grandmother was a thief, too.
Fairwind choked up a mouthful of rum.
Pardon?
He should have heard the footsteps coming, but Fairwind had distracted him. There was a frantic pounding on the door.
Captain! Captain!
No sooner had both men leaped to their feet than the bold Arva listed precariously, sending book and tumbler and bottle and men careening toward the liquor cabinet. Flynn wasn't sober enough to keep his balance, arms flying out as he went along with the rest of the items not nailed down and crashed into Matthias. The spymaster caught him by the shoulders. Thanks, Flynn muttered, not moving away. Sounds like trouble. Matthias had never observed the other man from this distance. He hadn't noticed that Flynn smelled as strongly of salt and soap as he did of whiskey, and the combination was intoxicating. His leather coat was warm to the touch, holding lingering sunlight and body heat.
Yeah.
Shaw blinked rapidly, fully taking a step back.
Trouble.
Captain!
The door burst open and Flynn tumbled toward the intrusion.
On deck, sir, now! You need to see this!
New plan!
Flynn Fairwind could only hope his crew could hear him above the war drums of thunder booming across the sky.
We land, and we land fast, if we can land at all. Oh, please let there be land out there somewhere!
He couldn't remember what it felt like to be dry. Good fortune had followed him for less than a full day. Choppy seas were a welcome change from the last storm, but now they faced another wall of rising, deadly waves. Ordinarily, he would blame the drinking for his confusion, but even a sober man would know that these storms were unnatural. Rain poured down less like a squall and more like bucket after bucket being dumped directly on his head. The winds tore at their sails viciously, blowing in random directions that defied even the most skilled sailor's steering ability.
Melly! Melly, if you're still aboard and alive, get us to shore!
Flynn crashed across the main deck, using any spare piece of rigging or barrel or railing to reach the stern, where he hoped to find their tide sage and their only hope of surviving the storm. The shearing wind caught any voice and carried it away. A seagull whipped by his head, rocketing out to the sea behind him like a squawking cannonball. He flattened his hand above his eyes, but it was pointless. There was nothing to see but a solid sheet of rain and darkness. A door. Finally. He threw himself toward the quarterdeck, the stairs leading upward providing a railing to which he clung desperately. The door behind him banged open, the gale catching it and slamming it hard enough to scatter splinters across the floor.
Shaw!
The spymaster emerged, already shouting something, a black, sodden cloak pulled up over his head. He yelled again, but the sound was lost. They were almost nose to nose, but it was bloody impossible to make out a single word.
What?
Flynn grabbed him by the shoulders.
I can't read lips. What are you saying?
The wind changed direction suddenly, flipping the sails the other way with a clap, leaving a brief, swirling vortex of quiet.
Land!
A warning? A jubilation? Flynn felt the bold Arva lurch and heard the ear-rending crunch no captain ever wanted to hear. The hull had made contact, rowdy contact, with a sandbar, though it appeared to be intact. He and Shaw hit the boards and slid, luckily, into the quarterdeck. Unluckily, an instant later, the rest of his crew appeared, tumbling toward them, until Flynn, Shaw, and half a dozen bedraggled limp sailors lay in a groaning heap, piled at the bottom of the quarterdeck.